welcome back to the Hall Pass podcast. Today we'll be discussing recommendation letters, when and how to submit them, who to get them from, why they're important, things like that, and most importantly, how students should start preparing for them. So I'm super excited to have our full crew back. Travis, Punkage, and Jay are back in action.
Hey Jenny.
Hey guys.
We're back.
Back in action.
Full squad.
Back in business.
Travis had a really cool rap for us this morning.
I did. I don't know if I can repeat it twice. So greatness only happens once in a day sometimes.
Oh, dear. Punkage, although, had a follow-up and his rap was
and it was
not
terrible.
That great.
It was a big fail.
It's tough to follow up on the Eminem of AM.
Is that what you call yourself?
Yeah, that's how I introduce myself to students now.
Hi, I'm the Eminem.
I thought I was meeting with Counselor Travis. Wrong.
Wrong again. You're actually meeting with Eminem from AM. No wonder you're so good with words.
Yeah. You know, I just, rapping is basically just poetry.
Yeah.
You know.
With a beat.
With a beat.
Exactly. Okay, so we're going to start. Let's just dive right into recommendation letters. I'll kind of talk a little bit about what they are and, you know, what to expect from them. So in the college application process, you can expect that there are two teacher recommendation letters that are usually required by most colleges and one counselor recommendation letter. Although it's not really a letter, it's more of an evaluation. It's a series of questions that they're asked on a scale, and they have to say if you're above average or below average or top 1%. Things like that. And then there's a little comment section for them at the end of the recommendation. Some college will also allow for supplemental recommendation letters. So if you had a soccer coach or someone else that, you know, or an employer or something that could speak highly of who you are, then you might be able to submit that supplemental rec letter. We talked about supplemental materials in our last episode. So in case you missed it, go back and listen to it. For supplemental recommendation letters, you know, a lot of colleges will allow you to submit them. Some have an unlimited amount, although I wouldn't recommend sending them 100 supplemental recommendation letters. But, you know, one or two extra could potentially add value to your application in the case that they say something about you that isn't already in your teacher recs. In terms of uploading recommendation letters, usually colleges go on to, teachers and counselors go on to the common application. There's a place where students invite teachers and counselors to come on and submit their recommendation letters, and the common application will send them an email letting them know how to sign up for the process and how to submit. Some high schools have a program called Naviance. If you don't know what this is, you might want to ask your high school counselor if this is something that your high school has available. And Naviance is a portal that a lot of high schools use to submit teacher recommendation letters and things like that. And so, those are two of the most common ways. I'm sure some other high schools have their own portals as well, but Common App or Naviance, I would say, are the two most common ways to upload your rec letters. And students do not upload the rec letters. The counselor and the teachers are the ones that upload them. Yes, Punkage.
So Jenny, I still had a question, because I remember back in the day, they used to use an actual envelope and a stamp.
What is that? Wait a second. What is a stamp? What is an envelope?
But they used to snail mail it to the colleges. Does that still happen, or is it all digital now with uploading?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the ones that are required by the college application, so for Common App and the teacher evaluation and things like that, the counselor evaluation, I would say those are all on the common application. It's not stamp and envelope or whatever those things are, okay?
The horse and buggy days.
But for supplemental recommendation letters, a lot of colleges might ask the supplemental recommender to just submit it on their own through snail mail. And so if they don't have the portal available online, then you just have to use what is called an envelope and a stamp to then mail them.
That's a lot rarer these days. Most of them are going to the digital system. So, mm-hmm. But in the case that you do have that offshoot and you have to do the snail mail approach, I think proper custom back when we were applying was to, you know, properly get the envelope ready, pre-fill out the address to where it's going to send to, mm-hmm. and make sure
stamp
that it's
it.
Yeah, it's ease of mind for the teacher.
So yeah, make sure you give those things to the teachers or the employers or whoever is going to be sending that, so that all they need to do is print out your recommendation letter.
Slip it in,
send it wherever. Where do you go to put those things in there? You go to a mailbox? Oh, the post office. Yeah, so you'll have to go to the post office. The teachers can do that or the employers can do that. So let's dive right into kind of the strategy behind teacher recommendation letters. Like, how do we choose, you know, who to get letters of rec from? You know, what do we do? You know, how, you know, just a lot of these questions that students and parents have in general, like, how do I choose the right people? Who do I choose? Who do I go to? So yeah, Jay and Travis, why don't you guys kind of delve into that a little bit?
One of the most important things is to make sure that you look at the application and identify what kind of recommendation letter they're looking for. Because sometimes they will specify whether they want it to be an academic teacher. Sometimes they'll ask for one of a specific subject. Sometimes they'll ask for one from a counselor. Sometimes it'll be from a non-academic supervisor, I guess you'd call them, or just a different adult. So once you kind of whittle it down to who you need to go to, then it just comes down to who do you think is going to write you the best rec letter. So for example, if you have an A in AP Psych, but you don't really have a great relationship for the teacher, or it's just strictly like what you go over in class and you don't really talk to him all that much, and then you have, say, a B in AP World History, but you and the teacher are really tight, you get along really well, and you know that they would give you kind of a glowing recommendation, that's the one that I would go with. It's not all necessarily what class am I doing the best in, it's who do I have the best rapport with, who's going to put me in the best light, and who's going to give me the best chance to get accepted into whatever it is you are applying for. So those are my two standards, is make sure you are finding out the right teacher to write you the letter. You know, if they ask you for a counselor, you don't want to give them your basketball coach. And then two, after that, who's going to give you the best letter?
So I can approach this, I guess, more from a metric point of view. Generally speaking, the colleges like to see that you're asking your most academically difficult course teaching faculty. So that would probably be 11th grade and the AP courses, if you're taking AP courses, those teachers. Despite that, I do see from time to time students asking 10th grade teachers, depending on the circumstance, because in the end, the student has to make that personal judgment as to who's going to vouch for this student's potential and studentship the most. Aside from preferring 11th grade but being open to that, I also think that a lot of colleges have specified what type of letter they're looking for. So, for example, if you go onto MIT's website today, undergraduate admissions, and looked up their letter of recommendation section, they're going to say that two letters are required, one from a humanities teacher and then one from a math science teacher. And that kind of makes sense considering it's MIT and it's a tech and STEM-heavy school. Not all schools are going to have that, but I guess one of the things I want students and parents to kind of look out for is being able to look at the eagle eye view of the colleges you're applying to and then just individually going to each one to see if they have a specific requirement. Of course, in the end, you want your letter of rec, at least one of them, to reflect your major direction. So, for example, if you're applying as a chemistry major, then taking the AP Chem approach, asking for the AP Chem teacher's letter of rec could make sense. Again, you have to make your personal judgment call on that. Maybe you were tardy to the first period class of AP Chemistry for like the past 6 months in a row. That would be a problem. And so the other thing I want to go into is the metric of what it means to evaluate studentship and potential. And believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, the letter of rec is not just the letter itself that the teacher uploads. They also have a form that they fill out. It's kind of like a chart. And if you could visualize this with me, on the rows going downwards, it's different types of student attributes. And there's some of the more standard expected things like academic achievement, intellectual promise, quality of writing. But it also goes into things that are much more, I think, subjective and personal, such as disciplined work habits, maturity, motivation, leadership. They even include sections like integrity, reaction to setbacks, concern for others. And these are aspects that I think are lesser put to the side. You know, when I was growing up, the emphasis was raising your hand in class, being the first to talk, and essentially just being the very go-gunner, get-go kind of person. I was never really, you know, advised as to, hey, if you have a setback, don't pout about it. Don't be upset about it. Don't complain about your group project teammate not doing the work that he or she is supposed to do. Figure it out and resolve it yourself and show that maturity in terms of your actions in front of the teacher. These are all very important aspects. On the left to right going, columns, how they evaluate you is a measure of your percentile. So 10%, top 10%, excellent behavior, excellent work habit, excellent maturity. Then there's like top 5% outstanding. And then there's this kicker. It's the highest category of them all. It's literally one of the top few I've ever encountered in my career, top 1%. So being
you
able
wanna
to
be there.
Yeah.
Especially if you're applying to MIT.
Yeah.
So it's not just the letter. It's also this chart that they fill out that has a calculatable or calculative kind of metric to it. But yeah, I think students need to start to realize this as early as ninth grade because you want to set in good habits. It's not just about your academic performance. It's your all around, your personality, how you behave with others, how others look up or think about you as well. Your social context becomes very important here.
It's very interesting to see the evolution of the letter of rec over the years and over the decades, actually, where it just was a letter. Really, it was a request for a letter. It was very qualitative, subjective on the student, and relationships mattered a lot. Now with this chart, and it's been there for, I don't know how long, maybe 15 years, and even the chart has expanded. It's very quantitative. They have that component, too. So as a student, you have to look and balance both elements. You can have, I think, Travis, you mentioned that you can have the greatest connection with a teacher, but you have a B. You know you're not going to have some of the best ever kind of categories in the quantitative part of the letter of recommendation. But it's that balance you got to try to achieve to get the best overall rec for the school. And so, Jay, I had a quick question on what you were saying. So you can have different teachers, right?
Yes.
Per school.
Mm-hmm. Yep, correct. You can.
So you can strategically decide, like you should have like a cohort of maybe 3, 4, 5 teachers that you can kind of pick and choose between depending on the schools. Is that a good strategy?
Yeah, so let me clarify. When you are applying, this is the best way I explain it to the students and the parents, okay? When you go through the Common App, most private schools are on the Common App, and you're thinking about inviting different kinds of teachers to different colleges, what you want to think of the letter of recommendation kind of deposit as like a letter bank. So you can invite as many letter recommenders as you'd like, and they go into this letter bank. When you apply for college, each college will then ask you to go to that letter bank and decide, hey, what are the one or two teachers from this bank you would like to attach to this particular school? So it's definitely possible for you to have two sets of, like, two teachers for Harvard and then two different teachers for, let's say, Georgetown or MIT or other schools. That's not a good example because they're not all both Common App. Let's say two for Harvard, then two separate for Columbia, depending on how maybe you might be strategizing the difference in your major choice. Mm-hmm. I think a good example of this would be for an engineering school. You want to have STEM-heavy letter recs, whereas for if you're trying to go more science, technology, and society, more interdisciplinary for, let's say, Yale, then you may want to have a humanities and a STEM teacher. Mm-hmm. And so you are able to customize.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing to kind of understand at this point is, you know, a lot of students come up to me and they say, oh, I just need to get close to two teachers then. That's it, right? But really, to have an array of good relationships with a lot of teachers is kind of the best strategy for you. That way you can figure out, you know, do I want to highlight these strengths when I, you know, apply to MIT versus when I apply to Emory versus when I apply to University of Texas, right? Like, you just have to really kind of take those things into consideration. So I would definitely say get closer to a lot of different types of teachers, get close to all of your teachers, actually, if you can, and you know, work on it that way. I want to kind of go into the how do I choose a little bit more. A lot of times in high schools, there are people that say these teachers write the best rec letters,
oh,
right?
Boy.
My AP English language teacher writes the best rec letter. He is known to write the best recommendation letter. Shouldn't I ask him? So, you know, that's also strategy, right? Because if that person is popular for being the best recommendation, writing the best rec letter, then you might want to consider maybe not going to them. And the only reason I might think about this is because if your relationship with that teacher is only mediocre and they had to write over 100 students' recommendation letters, how much do you think yours would stand out in comparison to some of the other teachers? Now, you know, other students, sorry. But now, if you were really close to that AP English language teacher, you were very close, you were in the top 1-5% in terms of relationship, that teacher knows you, has gone to your soccer games to root for you, then in that case, it's a no-brainer, right? You should absolutely ask that teacher. But you need to really consider that. Don't just go to a teacher because they are known to write the best rec letters. Go to the teacher because they know you the best. They know who you are. They know your strengths. They know your personality. Go to the teacher that knows you the best. At the end of the day, the best recommendation letters are going to come from people who know you the best beyond just what's going on in the classroom and beyond that. Do you guys have anything else about, you know, how to choose the best recommendation?
I remember that you know there'd be like four or five teachers or maybe less than that that would always be tapped as, oh, you got to get a rec from them. It's so important. But then these are teachers. They're smart. If you're an average student, they're not going to give you a glowing Harvard caliber, Yale caliber kind of letter. They're not going to, you know, purge themselves or like, you know, just like make things up, you know. You are who you are. Ultimately, it comes down to relationships and genuine, like your genuine relationship with the teacher. And you got to kind of evaluate that. It's very subjective, yes, but you got to kind of do some introspection, I guess, for as a student and as a parent of students to do that.
Let me flip the coin there. What I get less or so, but still frequently enough, is, hey, I have this teacher. She's an amazing Spanish teacher, but she, or a Korean teacher, Chinese teacher, but she doesn't, I don't think she writes well. I don't think she speaks English well. So I'm not sure if she could write me a good letter of rec. And what do you guys say to that if a student approaches you that way?
I mean, I remember when I was reading applications and I'd read some recommendations, really, I gave teachers a pass on, they don't have to be Shakespeare or anything. I just wanted to get to, the ultimate thing is you want to get the sense of the student applicant that's coming to your college. And if that gives you, in whatever way they convey that, it hit the mark for me.
Yeah, college admission readers are not grammar police, right? You know, at the end of the day, if they're not writing the best and things like that, but they're able to get across to the reader that this student is incredible, that's what's the most important. So don't worry about language barriers or writing capabilities. At the end of the day, your focus should be the relationship. Do you have a great relationship with this person? And that should be really the reason for getting a letter from them. I do also want to mention just a really quick thing. If you want to test whether or not your relationship with a teacher is really good or not, what you can do is for your summer programs, when you're not a senior, when you're a junior or sophomore, for your summer program, some programs ask for recommendation letters. In fact, more often than not, summer programs are asking for rec letters. You can go to that teacher and say, hey, do you mind writing a recommendation letter for me for this summer program? If they are not enthusiastic about it, if they're like, oh gosh, you know, or they look at you and they're like, you know, I'm really sorry, but this time, then your relationship might have not been that close to that teacher, right? Teachers should be enthusiastic about writing your recommendation letter. If they really want to talk about you, they should be like, oh, absolutely, Carol, I will write your recommendation letter, you know, tell me what you need from me or tell me how I can do that. They will be supportive of that. So that's how you can test your teacher relationships before you go be into your senior year. You can just kind of figure out, test the waters a little bit, like, I think I'm close to my chemistry teacher, but did they want to write my recommendation letter? Also, if they write your recommendation letter and then you don't get accepted into that summer program, I'm not saying that 100% is because of the fact that they didn't write you a good rec letter, but it could say something about whether or not your relationship with that person is strong. So, you know, I'm not saying use summer programs to find out your teacher tests or teacher relationships, but I think it's a good way to gauge whether or not, you know, you're actually close to that teacher, or the teacher feels very highly about you.
So, you know, we talked about teacher recs, who to ask, and the concepts behind those. But I think that one of the biggest things that I wish I was given advice on when I was in 9th grade and 10th grade was developing that relationship and learning how to have a good relationship with the teacher. The biggest epiphany to me, and I'm in my almost 30 now, right?
Oh, gosh.
Man, you're so old. Wow. What's going on with you, Jay?
Yeah, Punkage is almost 80, so that's really...
You guys ready? Relationships, you have to work on them. You have to put in energy and effort, and you have to build them. You know, I just thought you put them on a leash and then you take them for a while and then you leave some kibbles in the bottle or whatever, you know, and that's it. But wow. So I want to ask for some advice that you guys give to students. You know, how do you build a relationship if you're in 9th grade, if you're in 10th grade? I do run into occasionally 11th grade and it's kind of like a last minute thing. So any advice on that?
Yeah. Or tell us like stories about how you did it when you were in high school. How did you develop good relationships with your teachers and your counselor, especially your high school counselor? Because I feel like a lot of high school students don't meet with their counselor often enough because, you know, you only meet with them to get your classes, right? So use your own experiences. Tell us a little bit about what you did or, you know, any advice that you would give to get closer to teachers in general.
I think the biggest advice that I could give is just to be genuine. So teachers know they understand that students need rec letters. And they're also intelligent human beings. They'll be able to sniff out whether a student is just beginning to brown nose them and just like give them random gifts just to get on their good side for a rec letter, and when you genuinely care about the teacher. Mm-hmm. So if like just have a normal conversation with the teacher, pass them in the hallway. Hey, good morning, teacher, whatever their name
may
be.
Good morning, teach.
You know, and if on Teacher Appreciation Day, make sure to write them a thank you note. Yeah. Handwritten thank you note goes a long, long way.
Yeah.
It goes a lot further than say a Starbucks gift card, which can go maybe 2 cups of coffee, which is incredibly valuable.
Especially to teach you kids.
And yeah. my rec letters came from, so one was my basketball coach who doubled as my AP US teacher.
Perfect.
And then I think another one was my AP psych teacher who doubled as my next basketball coach.
Perfect.
So both of those, I had tight relationships with them because I saw so much of them.
Mm-hmm.
And with sports, I think that sports is the best barometer for just what kind of a person you are, because mm-hmm. they can see how you are when you win, they can see how you are when you lose, what yeah. you do with adversity, how well you work with a team.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't play sports, a similar thing would be with clubs.
Yeah.
If you have a club supervisor who also doubles as a teacher, that I think all of them have to anyway.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So those would be good because they get those extra hours with you and they see you in a different environment where you have to collaborate with the team. And that's where you get to really see what kind of person you are, because anybody can be a good student.
Mm-hmm.
But to work well with, say, Punky and Jenny and Jay on a podcast, that's something entirely different that you can't just like study for. You mm-hmm. have to learn how to be a good human. And that's what they want to express to colleges. Because mm-hmm. if you're applying to Harvard, they know you can study.
Yeah.
Right. You got past that test. You have your GPA and test scores. Now they're looking for, what kind of a kid am I accepting? That's where you want to get
you have
the teachers
personality.
Who know you the best. Exactly.
Yeah.
Deeper yeah. level of insight.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's what I would go for. The teachers that you develop those out of classroom relationships with.
Yeah. So tell us, Punkage, a little bit about when you were 80 years ago, when you were in
high school. Wow. Divided by 2, please.
When you were in high school, how did you develop really good relationships?
Yeah, it was a lot simpler back then. We didn't have any strategies, you know, freshman year, sophomore year. I had a similar story as Travis. My French teacher, I had for 4 years, all the way from French 1 to AP French,
mm-hmm.
And then he doubled as an English teacher. But I also went to French Club, which was this camp, like for a week. And so same concept. They got to know how you dealt with adversity, working in a team, you know, spending some time. I always like to, so I chose him, and he happened to be a really good recommender. Mm-hmm. A lot of people sought after his recommendation. I just happened to have a lot of time with him, so, and I built a relationship, got to know him, and I didn't get all A's in his class, mm-hmm. classes. You know, it was just, he knew me, I think he thought I was a punk. I mean, honestly, and he might have been very candid about that.
What a great pun. Punk, he's a punk.
I have had that many times in my life. But this is another teacher was, I was on academic decathlon, and he was also an English teacher. And so he kind of saw how we dealt with that.
Yeah.
You know? And during those days, I don't know if you can do it now, but he would show us after academic season happened, he would show us like Clockwork Orange, these like taboo movies that you're not supposed to see in high school or until you're at a certain age. But he would challenge us with things, you know, like some societal things. And so I like to always, at least students now, like try to tell them, be genuine, as Travis mentioned, just be a good person, be a good student.
Yeah.
Let them see the inner you. You know, you may be shy, you may be outgoing, but let them see the inside of you.
Yeah.
You care about things in society, you care about things in life, you care about people. Let them understand that. And know. And the way you do that is, in class, teachers talk about all sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. Their favorite movie, who saw Black Panther, who saw Star Wars, who mm-hmm. saw, you know, these movies. And teachers have their own interests. That's mm-hmm. why they are science teachers.
Yeah.
That's why they are history teachers.
Yeah.
So they'll talk about things, and you can kind of pick up on those cues, try to jump on those wavelengths. And invariably, you'll be interested in things too. I mean, I was interested in science and physics, and I gravitated more towards those teachers. And even though I wasn't that interested in French, that class, but he talked about things that interested me, and that I would talk to him during passing period, just have genuine kind of conversations. And then after a while, the relationship is built.
Yeah.
And then they care about you, you care about them, and then a recommendation comes out of it.
Yeah. A teacher is a person too. Teachers love having
until you see them at the grocery store and you're like, what? You buy milk?
Yeah. Teachers are people too. You know, I was a teacher for 4 years, and I loved when students didn't just ask me questions about homework or, you know, things like that. But they asked about my genuine interests, or they asked me how my day was going, and, you know, and leaned on me for support when they had maybe something that's happening in their school or with their friends or with their home life. The fact that they were able to come to me and depend on me and say, hey, you know, I need your help with this. I really value that with my students. So don't be that, you know, kid in the back of the classroom that never raises their hand and then just quietly moves from class to class and then expect your teacher to write a glowing recommendation letter about you. You have to be, you know, someone that, like Jay said, you have to put in the time and effort to develop relationships. And that doesn't just go with teachers. That goes with best friends. That goes with colleagues. That goes with family members. Like, you know, I'm not going to have a close relationship with my parents if I don't put in the time and effort to be a great daughter and a great family member as well. So same thing on that notion. And with that, I'd like to tell you a little story about me. So when I was in high school, I would say I have a pretty outgoing personality. I was pretty close to a lot of my teachers. But two in particular, shout out to Mr. Schultz and Mr. Sandoval. My US history and chemistry teachers were the ones I was closest to. And actually, I think it started on rainy days, because in California, you eat outside. So you have these like outside cafeterias. There are no indoor like cafeterias where you go eat indoors.
This still blows my mind. Every time I see a high school in California,
everything is outside.
Man, y'all eat outside. That's awesome.
Everything is outside. So when it rains, there are some nice teachers that will open doors to their classrooms and say, hey, you can eat inside my classroom. Well, you know, I didn't want to get wet and things like that. And so, you know, I would go into Mr. Sandoval, my US history teacher's class, and like eat at lunch in there. And he would talk to me about his life. And one day his wife or something made him ceviche, and I would be like, whoa, that's amazing. I've never even seen ceviche before. And then he would bring ceviche for like his students that were in that classroom to try. And then I eventually babysat his kids, you know, eventually as time went on, and I got in a good relationship with him. And then Mr. Schultz also invited us to eat lunch in his classroom. I got developed a really good relationship with him. Both of those teachers have been influential in who I am as an educator today. And, you know, I would say pick up on those opportunities, those small things that you don't realize when teachers open doors for you to get support or eat lunch in their classrooms. Get in on that. Those things are going to really, really help you and definitely go far. Jay, what about you?
So I'm looking back. I'm not sure if this is a good example to give to the students, but this is true. I ended up asking my senior year calculus BC teacher.
At least it wasn't your PE teacher. I thought you were coming with your PE.
No.
And there's nothing wrong with PE teachers.
No. I think the reason why I ended up asking her is because she knew my life circumstance at the time. So my first calculus BC test that I took, I got a 16%. 16%.
Whoa, is that like a lower than an F?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. It brought the entire class average down by two letter grades.
Rooting for a big curve.
And so, she was very shocked by that. And I remember having to encounter her. She brought me in after class and we talked. And I was able to then express to her at the time my life circumstance. I was living on my own. I had a job at Anaheim Crest Nursery. I was just kind of not really worried about academics at the time in my senior year, believe it or not. And so when I kind of expressed this all to her, she gave me an action plan and I followed through it. Now, ultimately, I ended up working my butt off and getting a good grade in the class. But I think the fact that over the quarter or the semester, she helped me improve and saw that I was interested or at least determined to improve, I think helped me a long way. And so that's how I developed my relationship with the teacher that ultimately was my letter of recommendation. Someone who gets to know what you're struggling through and how to help and sees that you're growing and improving, I think is very important. I do give a general tip, and I think I've given it before in the podcast in terms of how you can initiate that contact with the teacher. The simplest way is in December, regardless of what year you're in. December is a time where you want to start thinking about summer programs to apply to, and many of these summer programs have letter of recommendations. But before you even ask them to write your letter of rec, just simply going to ask them about what summer experiences, programs, opportunities that they would recommend to you. So say, for example, you're in a physics class and you're really interested in applying physics to astronomy, astrophysics. Then go up to your AP physics teacher and at the end of class, ask them, hey, I'm really interested in astrophysics and I was wondering if you can maybe help me figure out any summer programs or recommendations you have. Now, it's better for you not to go empty-handed, to initially say, hey, I've done some research, here's some programs I thought of, but would you recommend me anything on this list? Mm. I think that would show a little bit more initiative. The last note I want to give is for parents. I think parents, it's very, very important that you create the right kind of attitude for the students when in terms of how they think of their teachers. I always approach teachers with almost a distance kind of feeling, like respect and fear, authority.
Mm. Yeah.
And I never really endeared them as people who love to teach, people who love to learn through
people,
teaching as well.
People.
And,
yeah.
And so if parents can encourage them to say, hey, find out more about your teacher, get to know them, it's fine. I think instead of you need to be disciplined and you need to get good grades in the class and you need to be at the front of the class, that kind of thing. Encouraging students to be more open to their teachers and to share their interest and to use them for what they're there for, mentorship, guidance, I think that would be helpful.
Let's talk a little bit about parenting here. You know, what would you recommend for parents to do? You know, parents are like, well, what can I do to get close to the teachers? Or what can I do to, you know, get close for my child to get close to the teachers? So maybe a little bit like Punkage, what do you do? I mean, I know your kids are only in elementary school, but like, you know, what do you do?
But I think at a high school level, the most important thing, and I see parents falling into this trap a lot, is it can't be overbearing.
Yeah.
The son or daughter, the student has to be a young adult here, and they have to grow. And that, Jay, your point on growth is really important. Teachers have to see that.
Mm-hmm.
When they see that, it'll come out on a recommendation. If the parents are injecting themselves in these conversations and they're always kind of being those helicopter parents at a high school level, it's not going to bode well. Teachers will notice that, and they'll see that the student hasn't grown to a level of independence.
Yeah.
That is important for some of these colleges.
So
that if you're
a parent that is sending emails to your teacher, to your son or daughter's teacher almost every week or every day saying, oh, I know little Joshua didn't submit his homework assignment, but what can I do? What can he do, right? Mm-hmm. Joshua should send that email, right? Not your mom or dad, not mom or dad. Mm-hmm. So encourage your child to speak up and be an advocate for themselves.
It starts at a young age. So I just recalled yesterday, went to Subway.
Yeah.
And I've always ordered for Maya and Kieran, my two girls. And Maya's at an age now where she can order herself. But they're shy. They're like, Daddy, you do it. Daddy, you do it. And
yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
No, you tell them what you want. So they got to learn footlong, turkey and cheese, what kind of cheese, provolone.
No,
you know,
proper education.
They,
that's
they are,
so
they are
good.
Starting that interaction.
That's
even though
so
it's a Subway
good.
Sandwich
artist.
Right. They're not like a cook. They're a sandwich artist.
Yes, sandwich
but they,
artist.
I'm having my girls speak to them and kind of having that small sense of independence that, so that next time they order, they can do it themselves and they can have their own kind of selections and this and that. But it starts young, I think. And then it goes into middle school and high school where they can have those conversations with adults, you know?
Yeah, I really like that. Final advice and thoughts, anyone, before we move on?
Relationships take work.
Period.
You can't just get to the very end of it. Deadline is approaching the next day and it's like, oh my God, I need a letter of rec.
You're young, Jay.
No.
It's okay.
So spend the time, invest early. Parents, please give them room to grow. Give them the ability to make mistakes. And it's because of these mistakes that hopefully you can help them learn to develop themselves and hopefully show that to the teachers.
I have one tip, final tip, I guess, is parents can have their child be cognizant of the world. I mean, like today, you know, Stephen Hawking passed away, rest in peace. And like that is maybe a topic of conversation that comes up in science class, you know, students are walking out. That may be a topic that comes up in AP government, you know, or history class. It's good to be not always into the books, but be understanding of the surrounding, the world we live in, because those kind of conversations come up with teachers invariably. And you can have those kind of wavelength conversations if if you know about them and mm-hmm. if you're interested in them. You know?
Mm-hmm. I think if I can add to that, sorry. Instead of, so what I notice all the time is when a student asks a question, the parent gives a very direct answer. And in certain cases, it makes sense and it's fine. But I love it when I see a parent decide to recuse him or herself, take a step back and ask, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And allow the student to kind of foment and mm-hmm. develop their own thoughts.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say the same thing. I know my son's only 7 months now, but sometimes he's getting a little naughty. You know, he's doing things when I say no, don't do that, Jordan, he'll do it, and he'll look
just
at
like
me
mommy.
With he'll do it with a sly look on his face, like, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but I'm gonna do it. And I ask him, was that a good thing or a bad thing? And I know he can't really answer the question, but I think switching the table around, just like what Jay said, and putting the student to be the one that's, you know, if they're having a problem in school or they're looking to solve something, like, what can you do, what are your solutions, like, what do you think you can do to get closer to your English teacher, and talking with them about it rather than directing them what to do. You should go to your teacher every single day and talk to them. Like, instead of doing that, let them come up with their solutions on their own with you, and guide them to make the right solutions. And then that would kind of help with this whole process of not just developing your child to have good relationships, but also just developing your child to be an advocate for their own learning, and who they are. Okay, so before we go on to answer some of the questions from our listeners, we just wanted to thank you once again for listening to our podcast, and to subscribe and follow us on your podcast app if you have an iPhone. We are going to be launching an Instagram. Our Instagram name is The Hall Pass Podcast. We'll be putting short clips of us doing this, and we're trying to be a little bit more video friendly. And so go ahead and add us as your friend. And then once our content starts building up, you'll be able to see our content as they launch. If you missed any of our episodes, you can find us on iTunes or www.thehallpasspodcast.com. So two questions from our listeners. When will I know if I get accepted to colleges? So those seniors, class of 2018, who are waiting anxiously by your bedside and your computer to see whether or not you got accepted to the school of your dreams, those results are coming out now. They're actually coming out for the rest of the month of March. So keep your phone on alert, keep your computer nearby, and make sure that you're checking to see if you got accepted to colleges. Another question we got from a listener is, you know, I got waitlisted from a college. How does the waitlist process work, and what should I do now?
So normally when you get waitlisted, what that means is you wanna essentially put it aside for now, see the rest of the results, see how they come out. And by the end of March, you should pretty much have all your results by then. When you get to the month of May, typically May 1st, you have to do something called an SIR deposit, statement of intent to register. So for all the schools you've been accepted to, you want to eventually narrow that down in the month of April. Maybe this is a time where you take a couple days off and campus tour the schools you've been accepted to. And by May 1st, you put in typically a non-refundable $100 to $700 deposit. And what that does is that locks you into one school. We don't want to be,
locks your spot, right?
It locks your spot in an accepted school. Now, the reason behind this is you don't want to be YOLOing and deciding to just, you know what, I think I'll get into a wait list of Stanford of less than 1% chance, you know, that kind of thing. And so
I'm not going to put in an intent to register.
Yeah,
don't do that.
You definitely want to put in a intent to register by May 1st to a school you've been accepted to, and then you wait. Typically, waitlist results will come out in the end of the month of May to even as late as the first 2 weeks of June. And so
actually all the way to August.
All the way to even August mm-hmm. these days. Okay, so
because you have to understand how the waitlist process works, right? So like they're going to give waitlist positions, and then, you know, there's going to be by May 1st, colleges are going to have a list of students whether or not they accepted the offer. So let's say at UCLA, they wanted 10,000 students. No, 4,000 students. You know, and then they put, you know, maybe 1,000 students on wait list. Now, from those 4,000 students, maybe 2,000 of those students decided they're not going to go to UCLA. Never going to happen. But let's just say that that does happen. Then they're going to take from the wait list. Now, from those wait lists, they might have already gotten accepted to a better school, right? They're like already got off the wait list from to a better school. Maybe they really want to go to UC Berkeley, or they wanted to go to Stanford and they got accepted there. Then they're not going to take the wait list. Then it's going to go to other people. Then it's going to go to other people. So that process takes a little bit of time. So I've heard of people getting off the wait list up to early August because of the ripple effect.
Okay. So If it goes all the way up until August, what that means is essentially, let's say here's the scenario, okay? You got accepted to UCLA, and it's the school you want to go to from all your accepted schools. So by May 1st, you put in the $100 or $200 deposit for UCLA. Then you wait until June, July, even as far as August. Let's say you got waitlisted to Stanford, and you're really hoping to get in. And let's say all the stars align, and the college admission gods are in your favor, and you get accepted to Stanford waitlist. What do you do then? Well, at that point, you immediately put in the SIR and deposit to Stanford. You start the paperwork there. But what do you have to let go of?
You lose your deposit.
You lose the deposit to UCLA, and you're forfeiting the UCLA position. In that particular scenario, losing $100, $200, I don't think your parents will bat an eye, right? But
Stanford's tuition is 60 grand, so.
Yeah, well.
Good luck.
Then there's all the financial aid aspects to deal about. So there's two points I want to talk about this. First, a simplified summary, okay? So March, end of March, results come out. May 1st, you have to make a decision. You put in a deposit. June and maybe even later into August, you have to wait for the waitlist results. You want to grip onto one branch by May 1st and hold on to it until you can get a grip on the next. If you get a grip on the waitlist, then you can let go of the first branch grip, right? But with that, you lose the deposit, however much that is for the school. Another second point about this, besides the summary, is a little kind of a nuance of what should I be doing if I get waitlisted? Is there any action that I can take? There's a reason why I suggest my seniors to not indulge in senioritis, that your grades matter all the way up until the very end. Because when you do get waitlisted, you can appeal. You can send in additional updates and letters. You could say, hey, I'm continuing to get all A's in my most rigorous coursework I've ever had in my senior year thus far, and I'm continuing with achievements in my leadership, activities, etc. And that can weigh in your favor when you are toe-to-toe with another waitlist candidate. And so most students, I do advise them, you are likely to get waitlisted if you apply to 12 to 15 colleges. In that case, then it matters that you continue to go full speed all the way up until the end of your senior year, because when you get waitlisted, there is a potential for you to send in updates and appeal your waitlist situation.
Perfect. Okay, so thanks for tuning in on season 3, episode 3. Join us next week for our season 3, episode 4, where we're going to be talking about the college search process. Yay. How do I choose the college that fits me? Again, we would love for you to send us an email of general topics and questions you might want us to cover in our podcast at
thehallpasspodcast@gmail.com.
Ah, such a beautiful sound. All right, we'll see you guys next time. Bye, everyone.
Later.